Welcome, welcome, welcome to WISO Weekend, your weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenney. I'm very pleased to be with you on this Sunday morning. So on today's program, we'll bring you voices from across the social spectrum through Dayton Youth Radio, Senior Voices, Culture Couch, and much more. Up first, despite growing awareness about the dangers of concussion, sports-related brain injury is common among student-athletes, and the diagnosis of concussion often depends on a symptom screening test that's subjective. In today's installment of our Scratch Innovation series, we hear about a new Dayton-based mobile app designed to make concussion screenings more objective. WISO's Jess Mador reports its creators hope the app could keep more injured players off the field, safe from repeated concussions and potentially fatal brain damage.
Students mingle in the hallway during class change at Kettering Fairmont High School. In an exercise room near the gym, senior Emily Galantine describes how she ended up with a concussion 2 years ago. The 18-year-old athlete played point guard on the basketball team.
I was in a jump ball, and this girl was three times my size and kind of like went up and slammed me down, and my head like nailed on the floor.
Galantine's coaches removed her from the court. They guided her through a 22-point screening checklist to assess balance, cognition problems, and other symptoms that could indicate concussion. They also gave Galantine an eye test.
In doing like the eye test, my head hurt more, and I just couldn't focus.
According to the American Association of Neurological Surgeons, concussion sometimes involves loss of consciousness, but not always. Symptoms may not be visible right away. Fairmont Athletic Director and Kettering Health Network Concussion Specialist Robin Lynch says the eye test is critical to identifying concussion.
Neurologic deficit is neurologic deficit. If that system's not working properly, the eyes are going to tell us.
A non-injured person's eyes should track steadily across their field of vision and be able to change direction in a coordinated way.
But an injured athlete might just say, I can't do that. They might be struggling through it, but their eyes are moving very, very slowly.
The concussion eye test looks similar to tests police might give suspected drunk drivers on the side of the highway. Lynch lifts her fingers in the air at shoulder height to demonstrate.
And good. Relax.
Lynch is observing Galantine's ability to follow directions, and she's watching how her eyes move from side to side.
I am trying to objectively identify those things by watching her. And that's a little bit of a challenge.
That's where VI could come in. It's the name for a new mobile app Dayton engineers are developing. The app uses a smartphone or other device camera to play an interactive eye test similar to this real-life test.
Okay, are you ready?
Lynch hands Galantine a phone. She pushes a button to start the test.
You're just going to keep your eyes fixed on that yellow dot.
A yellow dot appears on a black screen and moves back and forth in different patterns.
Emily's eyes are tracking that dot back and forth, and the iPhone app is actually capturing data about her pupils.
The app records Galantine's eye movements, reaction time, velocity, and abnormalities that could indicate a concussion. Not picking up on these abnormalities could be dangerous. Returning to play with a concussion can lead to longer-lasting symptoms, and it opens athletes up to another hit to the head, and that can lead to a rare but potentially catastrophic condition known as second impact syndrome.
And second impact syndrome can cause major, major debilitating neurologic sequence of events up to death. Those are the situations we know we have to keep our athletes out of.
The VI app is the first technology created by Ascend Innovations Medical Technology Lab. It's a research partnership that includes the Greater Dayton Area Hospital Association. But VI isn't the first app to test for concussion.
People are trying to come up with a test that is easy to do, that still provides good information.
At his Wright State office, Boonshoft School of Medicine assistant professor and physician Dr. Corey Ellis is skeptical. Ellis cautions no matter how effective any app is, it's no substitute for a thorough concussion exam by a trained professional.
There has not been one that is clear-cut, do this, yes or no, it's cheap, easy to do, and reliable.
Design engineer Maria Lupp stresses VI's platform and its ability to track both eyes at the same time is new, but she says it's grounded in long-established clinical concussion screening methodology.
These tests are really important, and they get really good, accurate results, but we make it completely portable. It's a phone that sits in the back pocket of your jeans, and you can have on the sideline with you at any point in time.
Kettering's Robin Lynch says the app is already a far cry from the way she and other trainers used to identify concussion. Before the current protocols took effect, she says a lot of it was simply asking players, hyped up on adrenaline, to rate their own symptoms. It wasn't very scientific.
That just turns my stomach right now. But that was the standard early on. You feeling pretty good? Your symptoms are gone? Yep, okay. Well, let's give practice a try.
She says today's concussion paper screening is much safer than the old method, and Vi's developers say the app won't come to market unless it's at least that reliable. They're working to secure approval from the Food and Drug Administration as a Class 2 medical device. If approved, Vi could be on the sidelines by the beginning of next fall's football season. For WYSO, I'm Jess Mador.
This story was part of WISO's Scratch Innovation Series. To see photos of the concussion test and submit your ideas about innovation in Dayton, visit our website, wiso.org. Up next on WISO Weekend, Megiwa Orimo is a visual artist in Yellow Springs. The work she creates in her studio might end up in a traditional art gallery or carried through the streets during a political protest, because alongside her formal studio work, Orimo makes protest banners. She's been showing her artwork in galleries for over 30 years, but recently her banners were included in an exhibition of protest art called Still They Persist. Through the two separate practices, formal studio art and protest banner making, Orimo demonstrates harmony between artist and concerned citizen. Community Voices producer Tess Cortez visited the artist in her studio in Yellow Springs and brings us this story.
Artist Megiwa Orimo keeps a lot of cotton fabric on hand in her bright, sunlit studio.
Usually my banners are 3 feet by anywhere from 7 to 9 feet wide. You don't want to put a lot of expense to it. You use the house paint, and usually black, red, maybe some other color. At that point, as soon as I make my banner, the ownership sort of disappears. I keep seeing in Washington, D.C. and Cleveland the banner that I make. People feel really free to own them.
Banners have been used as a call to join, like in this 2017 protest.
In the 90s, Yellow Springs was trying to save some of the farmland from being developed. I started doing a lot of banner making for that. The last few years, I've been doing a lot of banner making for the local Black Lives Matter movement.
And MLK Day March.
Local activist Bomani Moyenda said that being Facebook friends with Orimo led to the creation of a banner that features a quote from acclaimed writer James Baldwin.
It comes as a great shock to discover that the flag to which you have pledged allegiance has not pledged allegiance to you, James Baldwin. I saw this, I think I posted it on my Facebook page, and she commented, you know, I said, wow, that's beautiful. And I said, you know, I'd love to have a poster, a banner. And she said, yes, that would be great.
Moyenda unfurls the banner to show me, and describes another banner, a portrait of a young man shot and killed by police at the Beaver Creek Walmart in 2014.
My favorite one is the one she did with John Crawford's likeness that says Justice for John Crawford, and there's a painting of him. It's been to Washington, D.C., Columbus, Ferguson, Missouri. It's been used so much that I loaned it out, and I've lost track of it. There would be like a vacancy in this whole movement and effort, you know, without her contributions.
To me, even though I don't put my name on it, this whole banner making and banner using is a public art. 12 years ago, I started this project called the House Visit Project. Instead of just showing your work in a gallery space, you take your work to individual homes and have a conversation around it. Eventually, that type of art project, it became so-called social practice or participatory work. And in a way, my banner work, it's sort of in that category. Once you create that, it's a people's art rather than singular artist work. And in that sense, I can think of that as an ongoing art project too.
Curator Maria Seta Reeder at the Wave Pool Gallery in Cincinnati describes Oremo's banners included in the exhibition Still They Persist, Protest Art of the 2017 Women's Marches.
There's actually two pieces of her work in our exhibition, Still They Persist. One that she walked with in D.C., which was, it says, Inaugurate Resistance. It's a white sheet with red painting on top of it. The second one, the Chin-Up Fangs Out, that's a really hot pink piece of sheet that she painted on with white and black paint. Those two pieces fit in perfectly with our work. Not only are they actually two of the biggest oversized scale pieces that we have, but they are a commanding presence. Contemporary artists, living artists, react to the world that we're living in right now and share their opinions on it with people who are also living right now. So that changes culture. That drives culture. That can make all the difference in how we understand the world around us. You know, I think that the world needs more artists like Miigwe.
For Culture Couch on WYSO, I'm Tess Cortez.
You can see photographs of Miigwe Oremo's protest banners on our website, wyso.org. The exhibition, Still They Persist, will travel to Oakland, California in 2019. Culture Couch is made possible by a generous grant from the Ohio Arts Council. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WYSO Weekend. Coming up later in the program, you'll hear WYSO's Bill Felker tell us that we're in the transition week to middle spring. But Old Man Winter doesn't seem to want to let go. Current weather aside, it is the time of year when homeowners think about landscaping and lawn maintenance, and some of them may plant new trees. Dayton Power and Light has a few things they're asking residents to keep in mind when planting trees. Holly Wiggins is the Director of Community and Corporate Social Responsibility at DP&L. We talked to her about the company's Right Tree, Right Place program and this year's recipients of the annual grant funding that DP&L provides area communities.
We had a competitive grant opportunity. We requested all the communities in our service territory who are Tree City USA cities, which is a designation by the Arbor Day Foundation, to submit for a grant which the purpose is to beautify some public spaces, be it their city center, their parks, another open space, someplace where they've lost trees due to the emerald ash borer. Doing things and the purpose is to plant some more trees, to spread the information about the right tree, right place, to install those utility-friendly trees anywhere where there are overhead lines. And they can also use those funds for other beautification such as hardscapes or paths and things like that. So after that competitive bid process, call out for those, we did a selection process and we selected three communities for those grants. Each of the grants was $25,000, and the Village of Coldwater, the City of Marysville, and the City of Miamisburg were all selected for grants.
Give me some of the reasons that those were selected.
It was a difficult choice, but those communities had grant requests. It was a large number of trees that they were planting. It was a replacement of trees that were lost, increasing their tree canopy. And it was the places that they were putting them, someplace public where their residents could all enjoy the results of these grants.
I understand Coldwater will be using the grant funds for a tree raffle. Explain a little bit about that, and let's hear what the other communities plan to do with the funds.
Oh, that was a really fun idea from them. They have recently created a 100-year tree plan with the help of ODNR, and part of that plan is that they are planting trees for the residents in their front yards. And so we are sponsoring this tree raffle that they're doing. So it'll be annual tree raffle, giving away to residents, and they'll be able to plant. And the help is that their arborist will be helping those residents decide what kind of tree is best for their front yard. So that's a really great way to share those funds and to make the entire city just a better place for everyone. The City of Marysville is planting some trees into the entryways into their city center. So their uptown Marysville area just has lost a lot of trees, so they're bringing that and trying to make it a little more luscious like it was earlier in the century. And then for the City of Miamisburg, something similar. They've got some parks and some roadways in the north and south entrance into their city center that will be getting some trees. So some of their parks and roadways coming along into Miamisburg will be greener and just a prettier entryway.
once other communities hear about the tree raffle, I think you'll probably may end up with more applicants in coming years.
I sure hope so. We hope that all of our Tree City USA cities sit back and think about what they can do with it and how they can make some projects happen that might not otherwise happen and make their communities a better place to live, work, and play.
This grant program really is a tremendous asset for some of these communities who perhaps have smaller budgets or are trying to meet the other needs of their communities.
Absolutely. And that was one of the considerations was, are we being impactful in that community? Is this a community that is not going to be able to do this project short of getting this grant? We wanted projects that would be impactful, projects that may not take place without some extra funding. And I believe all of those communities fall into that arena, and we've done that in the past. In fact, I know our first year of these grants, it was a community that had been trying for years to get some money in the budget to plant trees. So we knew we were moving them forward.
How else have you seen the benefits of this program through past recipients?
So this is our third year of giving grants, and part of the messaging that we wanted to get across and is something that's very easy for these communities to say, oh, yes, we will help spread this, is that whole idea in the title, Right Tree, Right Place. We want people to remember that when they go out this summer, this spring, this fall to plant trees, look up and say, hey, is there a power line somewhere? Look down and see if there's a box someplace close by and stop and think about, what am I planting near there? Am I blocking it? Is there potential when there's a storm and a branch falls or the tree itself falls? Is it going to fall into a line? So just because you didn't plant that 40-foot tree right next to the line, if you've planted it within 40 feet of that power line, when it's mature, it's got the potential to do damage and take you and your neighbors out. And depending on the storm and the severity, you could be out for hours or days. And that's what we're trying to teach people, is that it's possible for nature and our utilities to coexist happily and to help keep these incidents from happening, because we don't want people to be out when it's cold or rainy.
Since you mentioned safety concerns, it's not only residents that could be threatened by these situations. You also have workers that need to go out and try to mitigate the situations and try to clear whatever trees or limbs that could cause potential damage.
Absolutely. Very perceptive of you, Jerry. It is definitely a dangerous situation, especially when there's wind and rain and lightning, to have those guys out there trying to fix power lines, trying to pull trees and limbs off. People don't realize that if there's a live wire down and the ground is wet and you step into a puddle where that electricity's flowing, you may very well be electrocuted, and it's just not your first instinct. Your first instinct is to go out and see what happened and to go out and look at the car or the corner of the house or whatever. And those tree limbs on those power lines, it can create a very dangerous situation for everybody involved, and we do want to avoid that.
I'm interested in who supplies the trees. Where do they come from?
Many of those communities have, especially since they're Tree City USA cities, they have a tree council or some arborist or forester working for those communities. So those folks will be the ones going out and saying, yes, this is the right kind of tree for here. And they will often use their own labor that's out trimming trees or fixing things in their community anyway, that'll be digging the holes. So typically they have a local nursery that they have an agreement with to buy those. We have done some plantings in the past of the cherry trees, which we were working with Operation 1000 Cherry Tree Project, and they were working with a local nursery to get those trees in place.
As you mentioned, this is your third year for this program. Is this something that you hope to grow?
Yes, we hope to continue this program. We think it's a really great way to get the messaging out. It's a great way to partner with our local communities and to show them that we want to be partners with them and be a part of the solution and part of maintaining the green space around us and the beauty of the nature around us.
Holly, can you quantify the impact of this program to date?
To date, we've given out $275,000 in grants to communities. We've also helped to plant, when the rest of these trees with this last round of grants are planted, over 1,200 trees. So that's a pretty good impact in the Dayton region.
Holly Wiggins with Dayton Power and Light, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And we've got links to DPNL's Right Tree, Right Place program on our website at wyso.org. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend. Thanks again for joining us. Today on Dayton Youth Radio, we have a story from the David H. Ponens CTC High School. The country has been talking nonstop about sexual assault and harassment, and it turns out this is a conversation young people are also having and urging others to join them. Here's Youth Radio Project Coordinator Basim Blunt.
Dayton Youth Radio gives teenagers a chance to tell their own stories in their own words, and we hear them. Trying to make sense of the world. Maybe you're listening with your teenager. We hope that stories like the one you're about to hear promote conversations with the young people in our lives.
My name is Adriana Harris. I am a 17-year-old African-American teenager, and I want to talk about something very serious to me. Rape and sexual assault. Some of the things I'm going to say you might not want to hear, but you're going to listen to me. Almost every woman I know at least 16 years of age has a sexual assault story to tell. And most of them didn't even know that it was sexual assault until I said, oh, hey, you know, you've been sexually assaulted. Many women have been raped or know somebody who has, but men don't seem to know when their friends are predators. Your homeboy will brag about the chick he smashed without mentioning she said no 100 times and eventually gave in. He also won't mention how he had to manipulate her to get his way. My homeboy wouldn't do that. Yes, he would. And you know he would. Despite the fact that rape and sexual assault is a common occurrence, nobody really believes the victim. Can we stop asking, what were you wearing? Where were you drinking? Why didn't you call the police? What did you think were going to happen walking home alone? Any other question besides, are you okay? It's unacceptable. I believe you. Me too. Consent is not a black and white yes or no. We need a better understanding of what consent is. The absence of no is not consent. Just because I didn't say no does not mean that I said yes. Condom removal is sexual assault. Someone who is too high, drunk, or sleepy to function properly or too young cannot consent. Stop blaming the victim and start telling men to keep their hands to themselves. Do you know a woman who's been sexually assaulted? If you're a woman, maybe you do. Maybe it was you. If you're a male, you might not, but it could be your sister, your mother, your daughter, and that's why you're gonna listen to me. Are you listening now?
That's a story entitled, Can You Hear Me Now? Written and produced by Adriana Harris, a senior at Ponens CTC. Special thanks to Joanne Viscop, Jeffrey Crowell, and Katie Davis. To hear more Youth Radio stories, visit the WYSO website, or you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. For Dayton Youth Radio, this is Basim Blunt.
Support for Dayton Youth Radio comes from the Virginia W. Kettering Foundation and the Ohio Arts Council. This week on Senior Voices, we meet lifelong Daytonian Andy Hines, who grew up in North Dayton near Hera Arena and the Salem Mall. He remembers being a student at Meadowdale Junior High when Dayton City Schools were desegregated. Andy talked with Dayton Metro Library volunteer interviewer Nancy Messer and shared this brief recollection of the neighborhood.
When I grew up in that area of Dayton, it was 100% white. When I was in, I believe it was seventh grade, that's when the Dayton Public School System changed everything around. and busing students. And I can remember this, you know, as a kid. I mean, all my friends' parents were in a total uproar that there's going to be white kids and black kids at the same school together. Now, the problem, I guess, it was the white kids were not being bused. All the black kids were being bused to us, you know, in a totally foreign environment. And so I can remember when that day, first day of school was going to come. I mean, they were expecting riots, and the parents came to school with the kids. Mm-hmm. Sure, you know, they could get their kids out of there when the riot broke out. Now, my father, having been in the military, this wasn't an upset to him, you know what I'm saying, as compared to other people. That day came, and I remember, you know, going to school, and of course, you know, we're all on the bus talking, boy, what's it going to, you know, what's going to happen? What are we going to do? And we get there, you know, and you're kind of out on the playground where they would let you off there, and here come these buses, and everybody's kind of gathered around. Well, you know, they were just as nervous as we were about this whole thing. Well, it was a nothing. Nothing happened. And so that started the mixing in Dayton. Like I said, I believe it was actually my eighth grade year is when it first started. And at that time, Meadowdale was probably, maybe like 60-40. 60% white, 40% black. By the time I graduated, it was probably maybe the other way. Okay, 60% black, 40% white. Now, my neighborhood where I grew up is probably 80 to 90% black.
That was Andy Hines speaking with Nancy Messer as part of the Senior Voices Project. Court-ordered busing continued in Dayton for 25 years, ending in 2002. This interview was edited by Community Voices producer Dave Barber. Senior Voices is a collaboration between the Dayton Metro Library, Rebuilding Together Dayton, and WYSO. The series is made possible through the generous support of the Delmar Healthcare Fund of the Dayton Foundation.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the transition week to middle spring, the third week of the Golden Goldfinch Moon and the second week of the Sun in Aries. This week marks the arrival of middle spring, a four-week period during which almost all the field crops are planted and gardeners set out onions and broccoli and cabbage collards and kale. The Golden Goldfinch Moon is full on March 31st. This is the second blue moon, that is the second full moon in a single month, of 2018. Rising in the evening and setting in the morning, this moon brightens the night sky for wildflower walks. And if you walk the moonlight before dawn, find Jupiter followed by Mars and Saturn along the southern horizon. If you walk at dusk, look for Venus, the giant evening star setting in the far west right after sundown. Orion, in its middle spring position, joins Venus after dark. Behind him, high in the southwest, come Gemini and Cancer. Directly overhead, the Big Dipper's pointers, the outside wall of the Dipper, that point directly to the North Star, are positioned almost exactly north-south. As though to open up a great myth, the Earth reaches out to middle spring. Every year the circular stories about death to life, beginning so quietly in the tomb of frost and snow. Every year the plot is the same, and it's always certain, always beautiful, and always about the same length, requiring only a little experience or a little faith to see it through to the climax of April. And now, such faith is superfluous because hepatica bloodroot, bluebells, Dutchman's breeches, twin leaf, toothwort, and spring beauties all burst into bloom. Leaves grow on skunk cabbage. Buds form on wild raspberries. May apple spears are up in the woods forecasting morel mushrooms. The first apple and peach trees leaf out. Goldfinches, their breasts all gold now, chatter as they flit in the bushes. Cardinals now sing an hour earlier than they sang 4 weeks ago. Barn swallows arrive, and grape hyacinths bloom, and wood frogs call, and black tadpoles swim in the warm, shallow pools. And the pre-dawn robin chorus becomes even more raucous. Birds chasing each other through the trees and shrubs, across lawns, and tumbling together on the streets and sidewalks. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the first full week of middle spring. In the meantime, it's full blue moon time. Walk in the light. Embrace the story. Poor Will's Almanac for 2018 is available from Amazon. And you can purchase my book, Home is the Prime Meridian, Essays on Time and Place and Spirit, from the same site. The collection contains a number of the selections heard on this radio segment.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
That's it for this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958, thanks to generous listeners like you. I'm Jerry Kenney. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10 o'clock. Up next on WYSO, it's Vic McCunis with the Book Nook.